ask you to put back up the slide that had the logical steps on it? We can keep that up there.
The one with the four boxes or the...
Yeah.
That one? Right there? Okay.
And then if we end up talking more about the way you flushed it out further, we're going to put it forward. The remainder of the symposium, each of the facilitated discussions we have following presentations, we have kind of mini agendas for, and we'll keep them up here during that facilitated session to remind you of the kind of the process. So we want to spend about 20 minutes here. We have an hour between now and the end of this facilitated discussion. We want to spend the first 20 minutes having a Q&A, and then we're going to get into facilitated discussion and solicit your feedback on what additions, changes, or omissions you would make to these logical steps. And then we'll spend a little bit of time at the end summarizing and organizing those suggested changes, so hopefully we can get something more concise out of it at the end. So what I'm going to ask you to do now is if you have comments and suggestions about the logical steps, I'm going to ask you to hold off on those until we start the facilitated part of it. For these first 20 minutes, let's really save this time for any questions you have, rather than comments, direct questions about the logical steps and any of the things that that Eric and Ken presented here for you. So for 20 minutes, we'll just do a Q&A then. Any questions about this process first? No? Okay. We have Molly, and then Eric, and Tracy. Molly.
My question is, in the context of our what we're going to talk about now, who is the audience for the five logical steps? I mean, who are the target?
Yeah.
I'm going to just really talk to Matt Worker. I mean, how do you envision these and then the mini circles gather?
Is this a regulator sitting at their desk in this?
There was an earlier slide in one of the introductory presentations where we talked about potential audiences for this and referred to two groups, regulators and mitigation providers, as sort of the obvious group. And then sort of another group that we want to target are our watershed stakeholders. That's a big umbrella. That's folks that, like EPA and other agencies, that fund watershed planning and control the content and direction of the analysis in watershed planning, and the folks actually implement it on the ground. So it's both groups.
Well, that may be a task for us to kind of organize around it.
Well, in order to localize that a little more, this exercise here is going to lead to a guidance that will come out of the map, which will go to the district regulators for them to form their own sort of watershed approach to their compensatory mitigation activities. Is that narrowed down a little bit more for you?
And throughout all of this is something we're going to get into a lot more, I think, on the last day. When they put these together, there was some thought in that about the districts that this is going to end up in. Some of them are going to be ones with a lot of information, like in your part of the country where there's been a lot of mapping, there's been a lot of research, there's been some SAMs and some AIDS, and a lot of the data is there, and others are going to be very little information, and that's something we'll address on the last day. But these need to be broad enough that they're applicable in a number of different situations. So I have Eric next, and then Tracy, and then Savannah.
So I guess first is a comment that I really appreciate and agree with the statement that you made about incorporating the local land use jurisdiction involved. And I'm fortunate that the project I work with originated really from a local land use thing, and so we dealt with those issues first thing. Mm-hmm. Most of the types of assessments and schemes that we've talked about so far are not involving local land use authorities, and the information is really valuable that would result from these types of analyses, but in the end, it's all going to ultimately depend on some kind of voluntary action. I'm wondering what thought you put into how to involve the local jurisdictions.
Well, it's interesting. My observation is that these things are somewhat organic in the sense that they sort of evolve, that there really is a lot of local. I think if you go into most communities, what you'll find is there's some local constituency there. And it might be a city, or it might be a watershed group, or it might be a conservancy. And so these kind of local sort of place-based organizations, really, they tend to know their area, and they often have a lot of valuable information about those areas. And so my observation has been that these organic types of plans that kind of grow out from that, sort of if you provide sort of a foundation for how to organize that information, it's okay, this is kind of the type of information you need, and this is how you might want to organize it, that these local groups often, when it starts from that level and is essentially that the sort of state or federal agencies kind of become partners into that effort rather than the other way around, they tend to be a little more successful. That's been my observation than when sort of the agencies sort of impose something or there's a framework for we're going to put mitigation here, here, and here, and that's imposed from above. That tends to meet a little more resistance because everybody feels like they know their area best, and in often cases that's true, but that sort of bottom-up, in my experience, tends to kind of be a little more successful as long as you provide the right guidance in terms of what are the types of information that you should be asking and how you might organize that. So I don't know if that answers your question. Yeah.
On barriers, because I think that's something important, and so that's going to lead to my question in a minute. My comment is that there are also scales of barriers, and I think that we operate at different scales, federal, local, you know, tribal. There are different scales of operation, and a lot of the barriers that you actually address are at those different scales, and so I think that some of our, what I'm hoping would come out of this to help inform how we, the agencies, can develop a guidance that will be successful. I mean, the endpoint is not just to have a guidance. The endpoint is to have a guidance that actually is successful. And so with that in mind, I'm hoping that some of our thinking will consider how, at what scale we are all operating and what scales we have to consider in putting, and it's just what you folks are talking about. Some things happen at the local level. Some things are driven by money that comes at a larger, from the federal level, or the data collection that comes at a larger level that we're able to seam it together, like in EPA's Waters database or CORE ORM database. So I'm hoping that we can think of, think about at what scale the barriers are operating and how we can address those more effectively. Also, given that there are so many planning efforts that are happening, or as Molly mentioned, it's not happening out there. And so then, I guess my question or request is that I think you identified some very good barriers, and I think it might be useful if the group agrees to continue to look back at those barriers, because it's not just who is the target audience, but who's at what level or scale are there roles of action, where does the action have to take place to better facilitate success, i.e. not just a product, not just another, as you just said, another guidance directive out there from the federal government that could be contrary to others that are out there, but something that's actually going to be incorporated and lead to success on the ground. So that's, I guess, my comment and my question. If we could do my request, that we could consider those barriers from time to time and see what scale those barriers are.
Part of a lot of the things structured into during facilitating sessions, several of them have a little exercise addressing barriers.
So I think that my one response would be, I think that's right. If there's maybe a place that the map focuses, is that some of those barriers that are controllable at the federal level, whether they're institutional sort of cultural barriers or even information availability and access, I mean, some of those are probably more controllable at the federal level than some of the other barriers are probably more appropriately addressed at the local level.
So. But at the federal level, sometimes we make more barriers than we do.
Right.
No, that's true, and I think that's something we need to address, and I think it's something we're trying to address. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And watersheds. So I just think that we should all keep that in mind to better facilitate actual success as a guidance.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
I guess I just sort of have a clarification question similar to what I think Molly was bringing up, and that's kind of the context in which these logical steps are going to be utilized, in the sense of, you know, I guess in the discussion this morning, I'm trying to figure out how this is going to link to, you know, the regulatory context. I'm coming at it from more of a watershed management context, so I'm a little ignorant to the world that you guys have to live in on the permit level, but I want to make it work. So when you put up the slide of, you know, the checklist that you might use in the absence of a plan, that brings the question, before you even get to that checklist, you have to ask, does a plan exist? And if you then, that means you have to go out and find out if a plan exists. And if you find a plan, is the intent that you're going to compare it to these logical steps, and if it meets these criteria, then you're going to say, okay, then that's something we can use in the regulatory context. Or
the last day is really geared toward this, is you know, in areas where they have a lot of existing planning information, scenario one, scenario two, in areas where they have very little information existing, how they'll deal with this kind of guidance coming in and putting on a new kind of organizing structure over it.
So right now we're just focused on pure watershed planning.
There's a very broad understanding and shared vision for kind of what the basic steps are. And that's kind of what we want to, we'll ask for your direct feedback on now. So with this next 10 minutes now, or 5 minutes now we have, should be real direct questions on clarification about themes. And maybe you elaborated on that and put in a few more steps, maybe directly to those.
You want me to go to that slide?
Yeah. And I have Suzanne. I'm sorry, Bob.
The one comment I might make, Suzanne, is that I think you're right, but I think if 80% of the people writing permits are making sort of watershed management decisions, ask the questions you just asked. Is there a watershed plan? Do I agree with it? What parts of it can I use? And if not, what questions should I be asking? If 80% of the permit writers went through that mental process, then I think there's been a success. So.
Okay, Bob?
I was thinking about one of the example you showed where you had sort of an integrated solution. It was that watershed where you had the upstream areas where you're not going to have development. You would recommend no development, where there were clay underlying areas, and then you direct your compensation, if you will, is what we're talking about now, or restoration to the downstream areas. And I was thinking, in a sense, what you've developed is a holistic or a geographically integrated plan. And in a sense, that's one of the difficulties with what we're trying to do in the map item. We're taking a look solely, in a sense, sort of out of context in cases, the compensation part of it. We're asked to make a come up with a logic for locating the mitigation as per the impacts, but also in terms of looking at this plan that you put it up, expected futures. And your expected future for the for that restoration had to deal with the fact that the upstream areas were going to remain not developed, so it would not change the sediment regime, the hydraulics and materials. And so I'm wondering if in a plan you would maybe have other expected futures in terms of you're locating the aspect where you're going to direct your compensatory mitigation, it would take into account the fact that there are a number of alternative futures. And so my question is the inventory and assessment part of it, would it take into account alternative futures?
Yeah, and I think it would. I mean, I think if the slide I had after that map of Gabino Canyon had what were called planning considerations, and I think that's the way we looked at it. And that was actually part of a SAMP that Dan had worked on, you know, through LA District, and part of that. So it was not so much just compensatory mitigation, but it's planning consideration. So if you're thinking of that sub-basin as a sort of a blank canvas in a sense, and it's like, okay, if there is going to be some development, where would be the sort of the least impact, you know, place to put it? I mean, maybe it winds up that you could put something in the upper sub-basin if it was associated with stabilizing the erosion issues. So I think it's more, so the concept of alternative futures, I think, fits well with that, because it's not so much just where you would put the mitigation, but what you would do with that watershed as a whole. So where you might put, where you might focus your impacts as well as where you might put your mitigation.
So. Thank you. I thought Monica next.
What I wanted to do is go to the logical steps slides, and we may have to go back and pick this up. And I would say to you, you're a project manager sitting there with a permit on your desk, and there isn't a plan right now. So what are the questions that you would be able to ask yourself in these categories that would cover these categories? In other words,
right.
You can write our last name.
What I was trying to do with this slide is, these are not the logical, what I call the common elements, which is kind of a slight modification on the logical steps. So these are the logical, essentially the logical steps, just rephrased on this side.
That makes four of them.
More logical. It's more logical. And this was rephrased.
So that, what is the impact?
Right.
That's our first question.
Mm-hmm.
What is the nature of the impact?
Right. At a given site? So, the attempt here was in a very quick way to say, okay, what are some project-specific questions you might ask? So you could essentially maybe reformulate these as questions. Are there regional conservation goals that are already existing? Okay?
Yes.
All right. So if so, what are they? Do you know? Are there regionally rare wetlands that you're trying to protect or restore?
Probably everybody mostly knows that.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So as you move down, are there site constraints that you know of? I mean, is there development proposed for that area? Is that the right watershed position for that type of wetland? Some of the things Barbara was talking about. Here, is there a mechanism for ongoing monitoring and management? Is there a land, a mechanism for ongoing management? I mean, that was the idea there, was to kind of try to sort of recast some of these steps into questions you might ask in a project-specific framework. Are there other plans, multi-species plans or water quality plans in this area that we can sort of feed into to coordinate with? So that was kind of the goal with this slide, was to try to articulate that just as a very first cut, basically.
John and Barbara, this is me.
Is that me, John?
Yeah, that kind of.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I did. Yeah, okay. Just, I like the additions you made to the logical steps, particularly the opportunities and constraints and the monitoring or the measurement. I think those are essential. And a question was asked. I think Eric maybe asked it. How do you entice local land use planners to try to embrace these kinds of things? And our experience in Florida was, we said that if you embrace these GIS products and these HGM products that we're working so hard to help you with, and you put them into your county comprehensive plan, have we got a deal for you? We're going to try to develop a regional general permit for you. And the idea behind that was a regional general permit, saves us time. But the other aspect of regional general permits, which people often forget, is that if you have a regional general permit, you can use it to drive behavior. And unfortunately, what we found out was that the one county whose planning chief said yes, we'll try to put this in. In our comprehensive plan, she ran into the politicians, the county commissioners in her county, and she was fired.
So what you're talking about is essentially a SAMP that's not called a SAMP, using... Yeah, exactly.
Barbara and Susan Marie, and then Andy.
Eric, could you go back to your logical skills?
Sure.
There's an implication when you say logical steps.
Keep going back.
Back to the boxes, the four boxes.
There you go. Okay.
There's an implication the minute you say five logical steps that they proceed in order, mm-hmm. and that you finish one and then you do the next one and then you do the next one. And I would just like to highlight a couple points that you made, which is that that's iterative, right? And you can be proceeding on all of those fronts at once,
right,
and making progress as you go on each of them and returning to them as you go.
Yeah, that's right. It's, that's an excellent point.
That was an essential point you made.
So these arrows should actually be sort of double-ended arrows in a sense. Yeah.
Yeah. We're not wedded to the logical steps. Yeah. In fact, this wasn't the way they were first called, so that's a pretty good one.
That's why I had it in quotes, because that was not my title.
How about just steps?
Steps. How about the steps? How about the steps, right? I called them common elements.
Common elements. Okay, this is good. Yeah. Okay, I have, thank you very much, Barbara. I have Susan Marie and then Anne.
I'm wondering how human beings fit into this as an integral part of the watershed. I mean, I've heard them discussed at the end of the process as, oh, and by the way, consult with your stakeholders. You know, John just talked about them as someone that need to be enticed to be part of the process. But when you're dealing with an area, I mean, most of us are facing these problems because we're dealing with rapidly developing areas, and human beings are not just threats to the landscape, they're part of the landscape. And I'm just curious whether the processes that we've heard about have included something that used to be called the social significance of the wetlands,
mm-hmm.
and the need for people to have some say in whether they want mitigation wetlands to be in a more ecologically pristine part of the watershed or in their backyard because they like having wetlands in their backyard, whether it's a pristine area or not. And I'm just curious how that fits in.
Let me
talk about
it because Eric's got it right up there.
Yeah.
He, identification of issues, goals, and objectives. He's got all of that with the thingy on the right, coordination with stakeholders who establish goals, objectives with the people in the watershed. The issues are issues because they're issues for people in the watershed.
I think one thing that Eric did that adds that element to all of them is that he started off by saying the logical steps as they occur in the conference material start out with the landscape assessment.
Right.
But Eric added before any of that assessment and inventory is done is defining issues and goals and objectives, which brings in the human
component. That's a pretty important
thing. That's, I guess, I assume where you pull in the other agencies with the different issues and blah, 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 and you decide, okay, what we want.
Right. But I think Susan Marie's point about kind of the social significance is probably one that I didn't explicitly put up here, which is, I think, an excellent point because, I mean, I said I live in the LA River watershed, and one of the interesting things is there's a big effort along the LA River to kind of, quote, restore the LA River, which seems like an oxymoron, right? But it essentially has really very little to do with ecological restoration and more to do with building a sense of community around the river and riverfront parks. And so, you know, that may be totally inappropriate from a mitigation or a restoration context, but it's probably an important consideration if you're in any sort of watershed perspective is to be aware of those types of things. So.
Or a skateboard.
Yeah, and or skateboard. That's right. River Park.
And I think unless anyone has a really pressing question, we'll move on to trying to get your. We'll discuss whether we want to look at this or the original five steps, and we'll use this as a framework for really asking for your feedback on how you tinker with this to make it more logical or common. But I still have Andy in the queue.
This is, I guess, turns out to be a follow-on question, essentially. I spend a good part of a year teaching students how to do watershed assessment and write management recommendations. And as it turns out, wetlands are almost always a very small piece of that final report. Rivers, streams, a larger piece, but there's all sorts of cultural issues, economic issues, historic issues, all these things go into writing a plan, as I know, a watershed plan. Is is that what we're talking about here for a plan, or are we talking about just in terms of wetlands? Because it really ought to be nested in that larger context. And so I'm just need a definition of what a plan is conceived is.
I don't have a good answer for you.
We should the guidance of the MAPR is targeted at developing this guidance on how to make compensatory mitigation decisions on wetland, compensatory mitigation decisions as directed by the 404 of the Clean Water Act in a watershed context.
If I can jump in here, I think that's where the coordination with other programs comes in. If there's already a comprehensive plan, then you've got a great beginning, something you can embed this whole thing into. And I think that's the easy case.
But it goes to the question of stakeholders, too. I mean, I heard stakeholders being defined as agencies. A lot more than agencies. Oh, everybody that lives in that watershed.
Yeah, that's right. No, I don't define stakeholders as agencies, I think. Anybody who's got an interest in the watershed, right?
Regulatory targets. I'm kind of a little bit anxious to move on because we really want to get specific feedback on this, but people do have pressing questions. Sherry?
My question, where is decision-making in the steps?
Well, there isn't.
Yeah, exactly. I guess I would put it under sort of the way I view this is that the plan informs decisions. The plan doesn't make a decision, but it informs decisions. So through this process, I had on another slide highlighted these sort of middle three here. And I think here, this crux of sort of what you want in the future, what are your constraints and what are your priorities, in a sense, those should inform your decisions. But I think the reality is, as we all know, I'm not telling you anything, a decision is partly scientific, technical, partly political, partly social, right? And there's all these elements that go into what that ultimate decision are. So I don't think this plan makes a decision, but hopefully helps inform the decision. Ultimately, there aren't going to be other factors that go into that decision.
And Chrissy,
just one quick comment with clarity that I think would be useful. There's watershed planning, which is a process and an iterative process. Then there are watershed plans, which is a product. And sometimes I think in discussing common elements and we're asking where's decision making, is that part of the process? And so I think that as we go through, one thing to clarify is, are we trying to come up with common elements to planning? Because there are a lot of common elements to planning already out there to the process of watershed planning. Or are we trying to suggest elements that be incorporated into a plan which could affect, impact decision making? Some other folks are involved in both of this. Do you see my point? There is the process of planning, and then there is the product of a plan. From your perspective, Molly, you were saying, I'm a regulator. I have a decision to make. I go to the area where the applicant is, and I find out, is there a watershed plan in existence that is the product of a watershed planning process by a watershed planning group? And the answer is no.
Yeah.
So then we have... there's one issue there, and so I just am hoping to clarify, am I making sense to anyone, that there is the process of planning, which is different than a plan, than an online plan, and I think those are things we have to consider in terms of common elements and what we're recommending.
I think the idea is that they can develop common elements for the process. Because I will come up a million times, I'm sure, from now until when we part. Everything's going to have to be regionalized, and there's going to be, you can't really dictate so much what the plan should be, but it's the process you can help provide guidance on. The rest should probably be developed based on local circumstances and development pressures and stakeholder involvement and things of that nature.
And the other category is regulatory decision making.
Right.
So you've got the watershed plan, you've got a watershed planning, and you've got permit decision making. So we read that kind of different processes that could be related, but are not necessarily.
I think what I want to do right now is I want to get a check in with you guys on one thing. First of all, does anyone really...
Yeah, it's hot. It is hot in here. Yeah, yeah. I thought that was just me.
I know, we're standing under
it. It was really cold.
I know. It's been a nice day. And I don't know if there's maybe a small storm down in the basement, but there's a big ice cube in the basement of this building, and the air blows over, and that's how they put in that legitimate HVAC. I don't know. Maybe that's why it takes a lot of time, but we keep calling the people downstairs and trying to adjust it, so hopefully we'll I think we should try and spend some of the time we have only until 2:55, so the next 25 minutes. And the desired outcome for this session is to get your clarification on the logical steps, what you think should be in the logical steps, the common elements of a watershed-based approach to compensatory mitigation. So I would like to kind of try and focus a little bit more on getting your feedback on what you think should be in these part of these logical steps, these common elements, what additions you would like to see in there, what changes or what omissions. So I think the first thing we need to decide is religion originally when you set out the prior outcome document your material and slides with the boxes that Eric showed. There were these four steps: significant assessment, historic assessment, assessment of remaining resources. I was doing this from memory, so I'm not sure. Analyze restoration options and prioritize. And then there was like kind of how much, when, in case you kind of won. Eric's working with Ken and talking to a few conference calls we have, and we also solicited your feedback in an early mailing, which they both had when putting together this presentation. It's evolved into something like this. Mm-hmm. So when we have this discussion in the next 25 minutes or so, we should be focusing on one or the other, or a synthesis of the two. Is there a clear feeling that this is making a little bit more sense than the original five?
I like that.
Okay. I mean, I think it's hard to have some kind of goal setting and includes this implicit understanding about stakeholder involvement. So I think it's got more of a human dimension, which maybe we can then not worry so much about it if we feel comfortable that it's there, whereas the first one clearly didn't have that.
That's not critical.
Feel very strongly that we shouldn't focus on this one and prefer to focus on the other five steps. Okay. What I want to do is just try and spend originally that 20 minutes before cutting a little shorter, maybe 15 or 10. I want to try and get as many ideas out there as possible. So if you can, what I'd like to do is just try and spend 10 or 15 minutes getting our ideas out, minimal discussion, defer judgment. We're going to have, after we get the ideas out, we'll spend a little time clarifying them and simplifying them if there's redundancies, collapsing them so that we have something that's a little bit more cohesive at the end. So what I'll do is I'll open up the floor to questions. You can help me, I don't know, get a cue going too. And try to get your ideas out. Identification of issues and goals and objectives that should also include, or that something should be removed, or that something should be, what do I say, additions, changes, or omissions. So let's just get the ideas out with minimal discussion and minimal judgment. We'll spend time clarifying. Oh my gosh, quick, what's in
the
let's go around first. Okay, Eric.
On the development of ongoing implementation plan, I think either just preceding that or as part of that in the first part should be adoption of the plan. And from my experience, having entities formally adopt as a plan is powerful.
So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 steps, right?
Yeah.
So when you say a comment, you were talking about number one?
I'm talking about step 6.
Okay, so put number 6 here.
7 is coordination.
Just put number 6 here. And the next to it, right, includes adoption of
that.
Okay, Ralph.
I worked with the state of Massachusetts on their wetland restoration program. It was a watershed-based approach. And one thing that was important in doing that, one part was identifying potential wetland restoration sites, and this is just proactive. It didn't have anything to do with the regulations. But an important component of the whole approach was that they identify particular areas within a watershed where there are certain types of problems that could, that might possibly be relieved or minimized in some way by wetland restoration. So there's this identification of water resource related problems. Now, you know, it may come under number one or number two under there. Well, I think it would be right up front, identification of issues. Where do you have problems in the watershed that might be reduced or by wetland restoration or mitigation?
Okay. And Rich?
Okay. I'm going to take the other side of the coin, being an optimist here. It's identify those relatively intact pieces that remain in that watershed, the good, healthy pieces,
under
which maintain the processes.
Under inventory.
No, it's a super objective. It's like when you walk into a room and people say, what are your goals and objectives? It's like on top of the Clean Water Act or whatever. We're going to try to
say. Identify gems. Okay.
The second would be under priorities. There are options. There are multiple solutions. When you determine priorities and recommendations, there's a step in there that you're looking at alternative options or solutions to.
Number five, determination of priorities and recommendations.
Yeah, so in there be evaluate options. You had an options in one of the other, so essentially people have to have a sense that they are doing an alternative analysis and that there's more than one solution on where to restore and protect.
Okay. Moving along, we originally had a hand up. There are so many.
We did.
How do you guys did that without too much clarification was through to get as many as possible?
Okay, mostly we're talking here about watershed in part. So if I were going from a regulatory decision-making part, then identification of issues, goals, and objectives is what are the impacts then for which you need compensation.
Identify.
And I have a bunch of other things to talk about those in the regulatory decision-making column, which is going to be looking a little different than the watershed planning.
You're saying identify existing impacts or lost resources?
I have a permit proposal here, and so there's a proposed impact. So what is that impact that I'm trying to compensate for, or get them to compensate for? How many acres of what?
Right. I mean, I think this is a guide that specific. I mean, this is supposed to guide that when those specific issues come up.
Well, see, this is a problem with this. All of this discussion is your title is how do you relate this to compensatory mitigation?
Right.
And we're talking about when you have a plan and when you don't have a plan.
Right.
So right now maybe we're just talking about when you have a plan. Or how to get a plan that
how
then
to
you can use later.
This is ideally this process would lead to the plan. It would help you.
Okay. So this is not about the decision making. This is about getting a plan that you can later use.
But I think I understand.
Okay.
You need to identify the impact of resources, what's been moved already.
I think it's the inventory is for such a
Suzanne. One thing I would recommend is that the inventory part come before identification of issues, goals, and objectives, because sometimes you need that baseline information to make some of those decisions. And just to comment on one thing, I would also recommend that we look at this as a comprehensive process, because those 404 wetland or stream, I want to make sure we all understand, talk about streams too, can't be considered outside of the context of the other things. So kind of getting to what you were saying, Andrew, about whether it's comprehensive or focused on wetlands, I think it needs to be really comprehensive.
182 should come before one. Again, I think talked about this being iterative, and that Barbara's added iterative and spontaneous.
My experience has shown that I have to be strategic about the scales ahead of time, up front, thinking about the scales, the nested scales that I want to work in, and whether that fits under a specific category or is a separate category on itself. We heard so much about scales and how important they are.
Well, is it maybe in the first one where you're kind of taking out the first time and saying, okay, what do we want to accomplish here and what are our goals, and maybe that's when you define scale. Maybe number one should include define scale. Do you think where it belongs, or is it somewhere else?
Inventory assessment,
There's one, two, three.
I mean, you can, in inventory assessment, you can do a landscape assessment, site-specific assessment, detail assessment. So maybe that's, it's the scale issue comes in.
Scales.
Yeah.
You're going to have to do it. It's just where you do it.
Yeah.
Number two, actually what you might
want to
throw away might be the objective, because really the scale you're working on may dictate, you know, everything else. I mean, if you're working on an eco-regional scale or a sub-basin scale, may have a driving effect on all the rest of the
system.
Well, then I would say that's
identifying
the goal.
Yeah. Goals and objectives should should establish the questions you want to answer, and those questions should dictate what scales you work at.
Right.
So then it should be number two, which is what
Rick said. Right. The inventory assessment drives the goals.
Basically,
so it is,
that's putting
scale.
The two things together.
Before one, or a three. That's kind of what I'm hearing.
Right.
Where does it make
the
most sense?
Jim Gosling says you got to set a boundary before you can do anything. So
there's a chicken or the egg thing going on here. It's like, where are you? That starts the game.
The scale issue is beyond just setting a boundary. You need to set a boundary. But what do you analyze? At what scales do you analyze within your study area? Whatever that catchment, that's what I was trying to get at.
Okay. I've talked to Maria over here, and so let me just first, let me get up to this around here. Barbara, Fred, Steve.
I'll just play off of what Molly said. We don't want to, in the identification of issues, goals, and objectives, we don't want to, we're not talking about, I understand at this point, a case-by-case permit, but we most certainly can, when we're talking about that, talk about overall things that the regulatory program is seeing. There are cases where there's just incredible growth rates of development, and we know where those hotspots are in the U.S.
Number one should also
define some
critical issues.
Regulatory critical issues, and that could be, you know, there's mining in this area. It's a high development for mining. It's high development for houses in general terms.
Okay. Josh, would you like to?
Yeah. I like the idea of simultaneous imperative. I think despite that, it is very important that it is now up there. Analysis of opportunities and constraints come before determining priorities and recommendations. And I'm not even sure it definitely has to come after setting the goals. I guess that's my main point. So I just want to make the point that it may be simultaneous, but it's really important to get your goals out there, decide what you want to do first before you start labeling onto things, opportunities, and constraints. Because the result is you won't achieve what you really could if you start falling prey to the opportunity to the constraints.
So the sequence is working for you.
The sequence is working. I want to make sure that even though it's simultaneous and iterative, that the goals precede the constraints.
1, 2, 3, 4. Too far down
the line. Yeah, you want inventory first. But I mean, just. You want inventory first, and then you want
to. Barbara, Fred, thanks, and then Steve.
That me.
Okay. Yeah, just make sure that the constraints follow the goals. And then assessment, I think it can be very expensive to get into expected future analysis for some of this. You get into a lot of modeling of climate effects and sea level rise and all kinds of things. And I'm not sure that a part of a practical watershed assessment for this purpose needs to look at the expected future condition, as I understand it here. But in more general terms, I think it's going to be really important to get the language of these things. As it begins here, for example, what you have in your document, landscape assessment is fairly well defined. It's looking at how the watershed works. And I think what we saw with Eric's example is that you look at sediment supply. Because you look at sediment supply, you can see how the watershed works. We look at Barbara's presentation, you look at water supply. When she looked at the water supply, she can see how the watershed works. So if we get back to that kind of language, then I think assessment becomes more meaningful.
So can you reiterate so we can capture that a little better? So the assessment you're saying, the assessment and inventory stage, when we the original study outcomes, the sequence was historic assessment of existing existing landscape assessment, historic, and then remaining. I understand what you're saying. Expected future is kind of, that's nice to have a pun in.
Yeah.
But might not be realistic. But is that your main point, or?
Well, we're going to come back to the details of that, so I'll talk about that. But yeah, I'd be careful with expected futures.
Okay.
The feedback, it had been said before, unless you have it on your list up there, as Barbara was indicating, that these arrows only go both ways, as Eric said too, and the feedback loop probably needs to come all the way down. So whatever the last step ends up being, this thing needs to feed that all the way to the top, from the bottom.
Just bring up the blue pen, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right,
because
you can't
page
from one slide to the next.
Okay, Steve Along, this is you. I've got Bob.
I wanted to reiterate that issues, goals, and objectives. I think that, in terms of the full-blown element or step, is the critical first one. Now, you may have a preliminary inventory of issues or whatever the resources are to help identification of issues and goals, but you have to really have that before you really want to know what you want to spend money on in the inventory and assessment. You want to know what you want to measure to achieve those objectives, you know, what the metrics are, how you're going to go about that. I looked at a number of watershed plans in the 80s and early 90s, and I would see strong stakeholder, big communication efforts for 1 or 2 or 3 years where there was lots of effort, quite a bit of money spent, and then they finally got around to setting what their objectives were, what the issues were and the objectives. A lot of money wasted, tremendous amounts of money. It involves getting people to be honest or to express their interest. And indeed, there may be iteration, you can come back and do it, but unless you've done a good job on that, you're wasting a lot of time if you're doing a full watershed plan, or full water, going through this full elements, if you don't have a good idea of what your issues, goals, and objectives are.
Thanks. So, can we have the third? We were starting off about that. First, to the desired outcomes, I mean, the logical steps. Fred? No, Barbara?
Spatially explicit.
Okay.
The inventory and assessment needs to be spatially explicit if we're talking about a mitigation action plan. And that was implicit, certainly, in what Eric was talking about, but it wasn't explicit until he got to his example, so it's not up there. You can have a list. Okay, we've got these kinds of wetlands, but you need to know where they are, where they've been destroyed, where they're degraded. You need a map. Yep.
Okay. Now, I guess I'm a little confused. Where did we move? Where did we move opportunities and constraints? Did we move it up, or what was the suggestion?
I think the main point was that they should not. If this is simultaneous, that they're not left too far to make the process.
This was terribly inarticulate at that point. Yeah. I would separate opportunities from constraints.
I guess my problem was the word. My issue was the word analysis. Mm-hmm. I mean, are we just identifying the opportunities and constraints and then basing where we want to be in the future based on that information? Or are we going to go through an analysis, which to me says we're going to look at all the opportunities and constraints and decide something and make a decision on what barriers those present?
I mean, mostly just a reality check. So that while the process is happening, you understand what those are.
Well, then I'd probably say just identification of opportunities and constraints and leave the analysis to whatever is determined for priorities and recommendations.
It should be identification, not analysis.
So just for clarification, I mean, I think there was in putting these together, it was an intentional decision to use the word analysis and to be more than just identification, but really to think about what are the driving opportunities and constraints. So I'm not, how it plays out in the end is subject to future negotiations by other people, but the intention in putting this together was to analyze it, not just identify.
Okay.
Steve, can you mention Eric?
Okay. I hesitate to even speak. I'm not a regulator. a little confused versus watershed versus your mitigation, but I will comment on this. I come from the water resources planning end of things, so I come from a planning perspective here recently. this is very similar to what they're going through in the planning process as well. So that's a positive thing. In my mind, it tracks really well. The addition of analysis and opportunities and constraints is where I want to comment. I'm not sure what Eric's intent was to have the coordination as kind of the sidebar thing, but I would have that embedded in here. And I tell you why. Wetlands are not the only changes in landscape features in the watershed that are ongoing. There are best management practices in rural communities. There's urban restoration types of things. Yeah, they change how successful your wetland restoration may be, so you don't want to separate yourself from other things. And one of the reasons why is, at least within the Corps, those restoration projects are cost-shared, and so it's not just federal dollars going into this now. And those cost-sharing partners have a very strong opinion about what ought to be done where and why, and it has nothing to do with a lot of things we've discussed here. So my recommendation would be somehow not separate out the coordination with other programs.
So coordination should be included throughout?
Certainly with that, but it falls out of the analysis of opportunities. It's your stakeholders fall out of
there.
Yeah,
I think it's fine.
Necessarily part of the analysis of opportunities.
It's for a separate goal of having that one sorted out.
I think that's correct. It's
subject, if you will, of all of those.
Using the bracket was to say that that's an integral part of every step of the process.
Sure.
I mean, I think the thing about that's challenging with this is that we're having this discussion about watershed planning in the context of hazard mitigation decision making under 404, but clearly any watershed planning process could be useful for a number of different resource management issues.
Well, you don't want to end up with multiple plans for the same watershed, right? Because you have different groups building it.
But having the right people at the table can help it serve many different purposes.
And maybe planning and resource or regulatory people talk on a regular basis. I don't know.
I have Sherry, then Susan Gray, and then Kara, and then John, since you guys are
the word coordination of programs seems too soft for the level of investment it's going to take to make all this happen. So I'm wondering if the very first step is scope and obtain buy-in for what the watershed plan will inform, Clean Water Act, ESA, NEPA analysis.
This?
Yeah.
I think that's part of the opportunities and constraints also, right? I mean, if the watershed plan, one of the opportunities of developing it is that it can be helpful for these purposes as well.
I'm seeing it at the very first thing.
Okay, so in the identification with issues, for example, identify other regulatory issues,
right,
that
scope
are
scope and buy-in that when you get through this process, it will inform Clean Water Act, it will inform your NEPA decision making, it will inform ESA
programs, number right. One. Included in the process.
It sounds to me like we are talking about how to develop a watershed plan that would inform mitigation decisions. And that's not the same thing as a watershed-based approach to compensatory mitigation. I think Molly got brushed aside a little too quickly.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about.
I think we need to keep in mind that we are talking about Molly sitting in her office with a permit in front of her and no watershed plan, and how is she going to look at whatever information she has about that watershed and her all by herself make that decision? I mean, we're talking about a watershed planning effort here, and that's not...
Let me, for everyone, I just want to make sure we all understand what this point is so we can capture it. So, okay, you're... So far, I've been conceptualizing this in terms of it being a process, and you're saying, and more in the moment, I have to make a decision. How do I do that in the context of watershed way of thinking?
Yes, and the way I'm looking at it is, you know, rather than saying, well, we need to convene a group and identify issues, goals, and objectives, it's more like, well, what can Molly sitting in her office glean from what she already, you know, knows about? Other people have already identified what their issues, goals, and objectives for the watershed are. I mean, I think what we're trying to talk about here is much more related to Molly sitting in her office than what has already been done in a lot of cases, which is develop a watershed plan. And we seem to be talking about how do we develop a watershed plan that targets specifically mitigation decisions. And I don't think that's what we're after.
I just want to jump in just to say that I think we're doing two things, because I asked that question before.
And
the idea was this was about the planning and parts of it. And what I was going to say, which I'll jump in, which was this, the product is something that we haven't talked about. What is the product that would come out of this plan that would I could have on my desk and then I could make that decision? And I'm thinking about things like a list and a map. That's all I have. Whatever all this stuff, all the paper, all the big books.
Well, before I take out the lot of hands,
yeah.
Before I take, we're going further out, I want to ask, all those people who so readily stood up early this morning on the map work group, I want to help you. I want you guys to tell me right now, focus in on how we should. We don't have here almost a time here, so. This is going to guide a lot of the way. Can you help us define a little bit more about what your vision is for these logical steps? I mean, is this a vision for a planning process? Is this a vision for what would be in a plan? Or is this a vision for an individual compensatory mitigation decision?
We have some words we'd like to put in his mouth. What does that mean?
Ban away. It gets back to again one of the first slides that we set up in Bob and John Gooden's presentation, who are intended audiences. It gets back to what this product is going to be used for, and it's twofold. It's both to flesh out these steps will help generate a logic or a framework for folks like Molly to make better decisions. And this framework could generate checklists and easy decision-making support tools like Rich presented earlier on that could help folks, you know, at their permit evaluators at their desk make better decisions. It can also do something else, which is inform watershed planning that's already underway or will be funded in the future, and ensure that those planning efforts include the analysis steps that would provide more information for folks like Molly in the future. So
this is
it's
both. A snapshot way that the decision maker should be working through the process of making a decision, as well as kind of a framework for a planning process.
And
I
think
that's
the
major
program.
Always.
Major program, as well as a framework for the planning process.
That's got to be two different.
Those are two.
The goal of the plan here is is to improve the ecological performance of mitigation. And that you have to do by looking at it in a watershed context from a physical, like is the water there? Are you doing the right class in the right place? So that's one question. I think that you could do a checklist for pretty easily for a regulatory decision maker to look at. Then you've got this whole other suite of things you can add on top, which looks at what did you have historically, what are the important things in the area, you know, what are you going to link your jewels together, does this fit in the necklace? You've got the basic thing that you need for the everyday decision making that I don't think is necessarily always happening. And then you've got this other part that you can add on, and maybe somebody's done this other part for you already, or you can tell them, if you're working on this other big plan, this is the information I need. But I feel like I don't think they're so linked, where I feel like we're mixing them up.
So a guidance document can't inform both of those things? It can't help?
It might be two separate things.
Tell me, just sort of, Bob Kendall's right on board. Can you tell me the two separate things you think?
Guidance to inform, to make a decision about whether a proposed mitigation is going to be ecologically responsible.
So you need guidance on for individual permit decision making, and also.
I'm just talking about mitigation now.
Mitigation decision making. So guidance on individual
committee of decision making, case by case, but then also guidance on the overall planning framework.
Well, and then there's this other part. And
That's the other part.
Sure.
That's what I want to get. Okay, I'm going to just see the really eager hands. time sum up, because I'm assuming you all want a little bit of a break before we move into the next 2-hour session. Okay.
No.
Let's Casey.
Okay, just two things. From in terms of what should be the role of this guidance, what role can the guidance play? The two things, and it's following along from what Susan said and all the others, is we want to have compensatory mitigation considered during a planning process. So one of the objectives here is as planning is taking place, compensatory mitigation, what Rich calls prioritization, what is called by many other names, how the plan of what are your goals, based on your goals and objectives, what is your plan? Our job is not to come up with a watershed planning process. That process exists, as has been described here. Our job is to inform where compensatory mitigation should be considered during the planning process.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying. When watershed planning is occurring,
right,
for a variety of reasons, we want to find a way that is
one of the many things that is considered during the planning process. Now, and then the second thing that I think is something we've talked about a lot is, and this is where Molly and all and the regulators come in, is that the product of those planning processes, in which this is ADID SAMPS, then informs the decision making of the permitter. And because planning is iterative, all of these steps are iterative. We are getting new information, new data that will refine the goals, refine the objectives, make more data available. But at each level, that will continue to inform. Right at that snapshot,
watershed planning should inform the mitigation decisions.
Right, and then we'll talk about more complicated issues. The last day is we discuss when plans exist and when plans do not exist. And that's why that component on Friday is
very
critical.
Eager. They're very eager. Okay.
That's kind of a hard attack here. So what else?
Out of the ways, we back on the road. This symposium is mitigation, compensatory mitigation, and the watershed approach. The word plan is not in that title. Everybody's talking about a plan. We have a regulator here. We don't have a plan, we do have a plan. We're trying to figure out the best place to make a sustainable compensatory mitigation cycle will do the most ecological value at the watershed scale. There's no plan. Y'all have got your nomenclature all followed up. We're off track. We need to keep bringing this back. We got planning advice here. They do the plans. We do the plans. We've got to figure out where to put it.
I just have one other comment, is that this follows on what you said, is that as far as Molly, the regulator, I don't see having a watershed plan next to her. And maybe I'm feeling a bad watershed plan. I don't think having a watershed plan next to her is going to help her decide a better location.
Oh, and I disagree. Yeah.
And I think
Don
and Crystal have questions, and then we'll wrap it up.
Okay. First of all, to Tracy, the Army has a saying that I would like to use to back her up. Hoo-ah! She got it. She got it right. We're really talking about two things here. As a regulator, we're talking about two things, and I think we've identified them. One of them is we need help to know where to put mitigation from a watershed perspective. I think that is what we are supposed to be about here in this meeting. After Tracy made her comment, I grew a second head. Because the other thing that we're talking about is remember at the beginning here, I made one of my wisecrack comments that command and control regulatory programs are generally fairly mindless. They aren't really mindless, but if you want the 404 program to work and do good things for the watershed, protect high-quality wetlands, restore wetlands to higher quality, avoid the highest quality wetlands, then the way to accomplish that is to have a broadly based watershed plan, a watershed plan that identifies the important aquatic resources in the watershed and allows a regulator to know how to consider a particular permit decision in the context of those important aquatic resources in the watershed. Does that make sense?
Yep, it does. And,
is that what
you're... clarify that as we go along as well. Any other... Okay. This issue of there being two issues. I think we definitely got that, and we'll try and during talk to Bob and Palmer and some other folks about if that changes what we want to do and spend our remaining time. In terms of this, does everyone feel like we captured your comments accurately? This is being recorded also, so this is just kind of rough guys for us. Is there anything else at this stage? We're not going to really be looking back at these again, so don't worry about them influencing everything for the purposes of a future conversation.
I would still, and I kind of got lost in the other things you were talking about, I'd like to see something about identification of target products in here. I think that issues, goals, and objectives maybe, but I want there to be people to have in mind. If we're talking about a plan that was used by a regulator, if we're trying to relate something to regulatory that's here, then I think we need to think about what form should the information come out at the end so it would be useful.
At the beginning.
I think that would cover
It's 1A,
I think. Issues, goals, and objectives.
Well, your objective would be develop a challenge.
I just want to